Hi everyone, welcome to the Precious Pioneer audio experience. Kindness never goes out of style. Let's do something great today.
Hey guys, my name is Partha Srinivasan and welcome to another episode of the East Podcast. I am your host, and on this podcast, we try to bring technology closer to your senses. We know how every single piece of technology in today's world affects you, but do you know how that affects you? So whether it's stuff you use at your work, like a server or a data center, or whether it's something you use at home, like a mobile app, or even the stovetop that you use there, anything like artificial intelligence, 3D printing, robotics, we will cover or have covered this on our podcast, which is the East Podcast. To know more about the episodes that we've already covered, please visit the website. That's eastpodcast.in, and drop me an email in case you have a topic suggestion for us. My email address is on that website, and we look forward to your feedback. But coming back to today's episode, we're joined by a guest of ours from the US. Her name is Precious Pioneer, and she is a fellow podcaster, a chef of 5 years, and a food lover. And today we're going to be talking about how technology has affected the kitchen and the source of products that we cook or we use in these kitchens. So Precious, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Precious, tell us a little bit about, you know, your journey of being a chef and working in the kitchen and, you know, just generally how you came about being a podcaster and what's been your journey so far?
Well, I feel like when I was younger, I've always had an aspiration to cook and be around people. I think that started with my mom. Here we celebrate Christmas and tradition kind of to make baked goods and then give them to neighbors. And when I was younger, my mom was like the crazy cookie lady. You know, she'd make hundreds of cookies and then give them to all of our neighbors blocks and blocks away. Growing up, it was like a very surreal tradition. And so I feel like being a part of that joy during the holiday season, I kind of wanted to implement that. And so I began to pick up pastry and learning how to bake. And I had a lot of inspiration on these baking shows on TLC, Cake Boss and all these different things where they create these beautiful structures, all out of cake and icing and fondant. And I'm like, oh, you know, that sounds really interesting. So I've worked my way up in different restaurants. I'm starting off with some, like a whole bunch of delis. A deli was my first job. And then I eventually grew into working into a full operating kitchen. Right now, I currently work at a winery and I really love it. And so that's kind of where my food journey has gone thus far. But then I decided to create a podcast. It's called Precious the Foodie. And I kind of wanted to share stories about food and teach people all the things that we're consuming, because with technology and food, I feel like there's pros and cons, you know, like I feel like when you create technology, you are trying to solve a problem or highlight and implement efficiency to make things faster, to make things with minimal mistakes. And I feel like that's really great to a certain extent. However, when we're talking about things that we're consuming, things that that's supposed to sustain us, give us energy to supply us with life, you know, that's the food that we eat. I think that it's kind of being manipulated both in a good way and an artistic way. That's what you see in famous chefs and gastronomy, but then also in a money advantage way and a nutrient deficient way. And that's what you see in capitalistic, like McDonald's and things like that. You know, like they maximize efficiency, but with minimal nutrients and to a big impact in the environment and things like that, you know? So I think you have both ends of the stick when you look at technology.
It's a very curious point that you bring up in terms of, you know, the technology that affects both the creation of food in commercial kitchens. And those are pretty much what you've kind of highlighted at this point. And we will address that. But before we jump into the kitchen, I want to talk about the actual process of, you know, bringing your raw materials or your, you know, the raw ingredients that come into the kitchen. So the first thing that I would like to know is you have processes that, you know, people are saying that they're genetically modified vegetables, and there are meats replacements that are happening, like the Impossible Burger or the Impossible Meat. What is your opinion about all of these things, and is that something that was really necessary? I mean, and where do you see it going?
I think that it absolutely is kind of necessary. But before we take a look at where we are in 2020, looking at all these modified meat varieties, we kind of have to look back where we started. You know, originally when we were raising cattle and things like that, it was very normal for local neighborhoods to have more than just one farm, you know? And now looking at 2020, like four in America, like four companies own all the agriculture. And we have to look about how we were consuming meat. You know, we consume meat only on special occasions, holidays. But now people eat burgers every day. You know, they eat pepperoni on pizza. They eat, you know, chicken every day, fish every day. We're overfishing, all these different things, you know. It's because we highlighted the efficiency process to make it easier and to the point where our resources are dwindling in that aspect. And so Impossible kind of saw this problem, and they wanted to create something that replicated meat so people can make that transition. But in the past, people have done that before, you know, with a veggie burger or like other, just kind of like meat, you know, but people won't really change for the morality of the reason of like, oh, it's better for the environment. They'll change if they can taste it, you know? And so I think Impossible kind of created this really innovative product where they could resemble meat flavor, like look at the chemistry, look at the scientific aspect of what meat tastes like. And there's these little proteins called heme that kind of give it that irony taste that everyone craves in a hamburger, you know? And so they were able to find heme in plants, you know, that same protein, you know, that we taste when we have meat, to replicate it in their burgers. And so I think it's a very good sustainable future if we're going to continue consuming, you know, as much as we are now. And because the thing is, though, when you have a hamburger, they said it's what is it, like 360 gallons of water that's used for just one hamburger. So we, even though we highlighted the efficiency of raising cattle and slaughtering them and then going, processing them to be able to be eaten, we haven't found a sustainable way to lower like the, to better... meat, I don't know how to describe it. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Basically, animals. Yeah, I kind of understand. So during the process, you're using a lot of resources and to kind of make that a little more efficient, like reduce the consumption. No, I understand that 100%. But then now, there's the other. Okay, now I'm stumbling. I've tried the Impossible Burger. It tastes amazing. It's like nothing I've ever had before. And I can vouch for the fact that it's exactly like what a meat burger tastes like. And yes, that is good and sustainable. And I agree with you that, you know, it does take the load off using so many resources. But then is it cost effective? Is it something that is sustainable in the long run? Because not a lot of people are switching to it. People still want that good old fashioned chunky meat that they will grind at home and, you know, make their own burgers or something like that. So how efficient is that switch, and how long do you think that would take?
That's a good question. I think that it is sustainable in the long run, because just the fact that you were willing to try it says miles. You know, a lot of people, to get anyone to change a habit, it's all mental, and they have to understand. It's not just, oh, this tastes good, let me just switch over. It's like a series of, for you to change a habit, I think they said it takes like eight or interactions with that change at least 8 or 9 times. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to encounter it frequently to be able to switch over. But the fact that meat eaters, you know, generally just tried it. That just says that moves mountains, you know? And then that also gives a viable option that wasn't there before. And I think just having that option says a lot. And the thing is, though, we are mirrors by habit. So if our friends are all trying the Impossible Burger, we feel inclined to try it as well. And so it's all these little systematic things that we kind of go through, like, oh, you know, they tried it, they said it was good, and how you recommended it to me and your listeners, you said, and you thought it was amazing, you know, they're listening and they're like, oh, you know what, I've never tried it, let me try it, you know? And it's just planting these little seeds of like, oh, you know, let me try it. And eventually I feel like that leads to, right, that leads to just change, you know what I mean? It's not necessarily 0 to 100, like, oh, I eat meat every day to, oh, I'm going to switch to this very vegan option. You know, I think it's just kind of, I think the biggest movement that we all are saying is that, like, okay, eating meat every day isn't the most sustainable thing. However, if you reduce how much you're eating, suddenly, like, there's 7 billion of us, you know, if each one of us decided not to eat meat every Monday, that would just change the agriculture astronomically, you know?
Absolutely.
So just those small changes actually make a huge difference. And I think that's important to note. So it is sustainable.
Coming back to my first question is, when I asked about the Impossible Burger, I also kind of mentioned about these genetically modified vegetables that, I mean, if you look historically, vegetables weren't pretty. They weren't exactly nice to eat either. I mean, those were had to be modified at some stage, and that's where we get, you know, these super large tomatoes, the super large pumpkins, and the different types of you know, fruit and vegetables that kind of come out into the market now. It's taken a lot of work from scientists to get vegetables to the state they are in right now. Is this sustainable? Is it healthy? Or are we seeing a drawback? Because even organic vegetables, for that matter, they don't have a long shelf life. They are more expensive, but they look exactly the same. So they still have the root of the genetically modified, or the, not genetically modified, but the modified vegetable or fruit. So where is this coming from? I mean, where do you see this right now, and where do you think it'll go?
So I've actually seen it on both ends. I feel like with every question, there's always like a double-edged sword with your intention, you know? So, I feel like genetically modified, no, it's okay. Big agriculture will use that and, use genetically modified so they are able to spray pesticides and things on produce so that, and kill all the weeds around it, but the vegetable will survive. That's not normal. That's like not the most ideal, because the thing is that we still consume it. So even though the vegetable, plant, or whatever is able to survive being sprayed down, we're still consuming. We're not, you know, we're not able to consume that and be okay, you know? So it's those kind of genetically modified that really is why the organic kind of movement came out, because we don't want to consume strawberries that have been sprayed down with pesticides and the plant survives. But when we consume the strawberries, we eat traces of that, and that's really not safe.
Right.
However, and as a chef, you know, in the culinary realm, they are really doing some amazing things with seeds, bringing back older seeds that kind of, they're called like dying plants, essentially, like, almost like a dying language where they're just not being used and planted anymore. And so they're using all of these old plants and bringing them back to life. They didn't survive because they weren't grown and they weren't modified with other plants. You know how corn was originally like unedible, like it was a seed, and then they eventually turned it into what corn is today. And so there's a movement now where they're modifying certain old seeds just like those to make them more edible. One of my favorite chefs, Dan Barber, if you've ever seen a butternut squash, they're kind of huge. They're maybe the size of like an average forearm. They're pretty large, right? Or think of like pumpkins and things like that.
Yeah.
They're really large, very watery squashes. And so he was able to work with farmers and science and be able to modify it to make them the size of like your hand. But he realized it kind of extracted a lot of the water. And when you reduce water out of something, it increases the flavor. You think of like soup, you add a lot of water at first, and then after a couple of hours, it goes down and all of the flavor becomes really intense, you know? And yeah, so he was able to kind of, exactly. So he's able to kind of get those vegetables and use genetically modification to kind of increase the flavor and make other vegetables more edible and more delicious.
So, I mean, you already mentioned that there's a movement to that effect, and that's definitely very, very heartening to hear. But is it something that's picking up a lot of speed? Are you seeing, and again, coming to the organic portion of things as well, I mean, obviously there's no fertilizer or no pesticide. I mean, there is fertilizer, but there's no pesticide. And and an addendum to that is obviously these home farms. So you have these people who are in apartments who are growing their own herbs, their own spices in small little pots in their own apartment, and maybe even hydroponic farmers. And so how do you see that kind of a movement also kind of helping this thing along?
Oh, you're asking how home farmers, yes. Like people, home growers, yeah. impact. I think that is actually kind of a big deal. We are trying to get more people to grow their own herbs, or at least, you know, small plants and things like that, because it's all about where you're getting your food from. And it's like a movement in the sense that if each of us grows our own small plants and things like that, then it lessens the supply chain of where you're getting it from. Because here in America, at least, there are only a specific location where you can get certain things. And it travels really far depending on where you live. So like we can only get a lot of our, like a lot of, most of our strawberries are shipped from California. But if you live in Florida on the opposite side, that is very far to get to you. Mm-hmm. And so to grow in season is the most important thing. Like you should not be getting your strawberries in winter, because that says something that like it was not grown naturally, to say the least, right. Is also important. And so if home growers can just grow in season, and it guarantees you get the freshest, high quality ingredients. And one of the biggest things that a lot of people like to grow is our tomatoes, like things that bruise easily, mm-hmm. Go through some sort of chemical process before they get to a grocery store. So tomatoes especially, they go through this oxidation process where they're picked green, and then they go through like this machine that oxidizes them, that turns them red, you know, it ripens the fruit, and then they're put in grocery stores. But that's so unnatural, because the plant will turn red on its own. And so you can taste the quality difference of a naturally ripe tomato versus one that was oxidized, because technically that tomato will taste as if it were green, you know, unripe, flavorless,
right.
You know, and then a ripe tomato, you can taste the tomatoiness of it, you know, the acid, you know, you let it sit in the sun, you let it grow, you know, so it's things like that where, if you can grow it at home, it's encouraged, because you can taste the quality. And if the quality determines good meals from amazing meals, you know.
Absolutely.
It's really cool.
So, and our restaurants, larger restaurants, I know for a fact are doing this, and even smaller cafes are doing that too. But what about the fast food chains? Are they kind of moving towards these kind of sources as well? Or what's the state? Are you aware?
Yes and no. The only way that companies move is if there's a cultural shift. Like we, like as the people, we have all the buying power. And so if you notice, like organic became really pop, the word organic became clickbait, green, sustainability, all that stuff became, you know, it's the same thing that happened like in the last 10 years about fat or sugar being like the bad things that you stay away from, you know, so everything's fat free, everything's sugar free, everything's, you know, it's a very clickbaity sort of thing. And so now there are some companies that are trying to pick up more vegan options or a little bit healthier options. I don't know if you noticed, like even in the past couple years, there was a pressure for McDonald's and fast food restaurants, because with rising obesity rates and things like that, they were forced to kind of, put, the calorie counts on their menus so people know how much they're actually consuming, you know, and things like that. And so recently, some fast food places have picked up like the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Meat and like these meat alternatives to kind of cater to the people who are vegan or who would like a more sustainable product.
Right.
And it has worked well for them, like Dunkin' Donuts or Burger King. You know, they've all picked up this plant meat alternative, and it worked really well for them because they cater to a whole new market. And so I think the money is there. So a lot of, you see, they're not doing it because they like, it's like a sustainable like choice, but the money is definitely
there
for them.
Obviously the consumers want it, which is why they're able to cater to it. And it's not like they have shallow pockets by any means or measure, because the amount they put into advertising and all of that fun stuff, I mean, it definitely justifies. But you are seeing that movement, even if it's consumeristic in nature, that movement still is there to some level. Which is nice.
Right.
Which is nice.
Right, for sure. I think people care. It's just, it's generations of tradition, you know, like it's Memorial Day coming up and, you know, the American culture is to barbecue burgers and, you know, like pork, and all these different things, you know? Mm-hmm. And so having that change of character, even our Thanksgiving includes like a giant turkey and things like that, you know, it's just... It's taboo to like people who don't eat meat. Like, it's like, oh, what do we do during these staple holidays that are centered around that, you know? So it's interesting. It's an interesting transition, but I think people do want to change and kind of just do better.
Okay. So now let's, for the purpose of this conversation, imagine that all of these amazing ingredients have reached our kitchen, whether commercial or home. And I'd like you to draw differences out between how these kitchens function. But how has technology or how has engineering helped kitchens become more efficient?
Okay, I can start with professional kitchens first, like on my day-to-day and work.
Go for it.
I think one of the biggest things that most people care about is food safety. And with all of our technology, it's exciting because when you get into a new restaurant, they have these new food safety management systems. And so usually this is like the back end of what most customers don't see unless there's something wrong. Then they really care about, you know, what's going on with their food. But that's basically everything associated with like food and health inspectors and stuff like that. With these new technologies in place, it's more tech instead of paper written. So usually how it went, I guess, back in the day of like 5 years ago, we have to keep temperature logs of all the food, of course. So mm-hmm. when our food gets to us, if you have frozen lobsters or if you have frozen goods or if you have chicken or things like that, obviously they need to be cold. They need to be cold at all times. And so we measure the temperatures every hour, and then we do temperature logs. Or if we have soups, like the servers usually have a soup station where they fill up their bowls and they take them to the tables, the soup temperatures have to be measured. Like everything that goes out of the window, which is where it's like the counter where we grab all the food, the window has to be recorded, you know, the steaks, everything. And so usually it's a manager or somebody with a paper and a pen, and they go around and log all of it. And it's humans, like we're prone to error. We're forgetful. We can get busy and not be able to do that on the hour. Mm-hmm. And so with the new food safety measures, there's these, they keep an automatic temperature log, and then they update into this app, this system. So let's say a refrigerator is set at, I don't know, 20 degrees or something like that.
Fahrenheit,
then
right?
Like as soon as, I'm sorry?
Fahrenheit, right?
Right, Fahrenheit. And if it gets out of temperature, like it suddenly is like 60 or 70 degrees, like clearly that's not working. Mm-hmm. So when a little alarm system will go off to go check it out, you know, like there's something wrong. And so it kind of killed that time-consuming task by automation, which is really, really efficient. And then also, it's really helpful because when food inspectors come and we're like, okay, you know, this time we can just print out the log and then give it to them. It cut down a daily process into an automatic system, you know, that we can just check every few minutes, you know, and we can see that everything's good to go, which is really nice.
That's from a storage perspective or even a serving perspective. But then even in terms of the production, like when you cook food, I don't think a lot of restaurants, or do they still use gas?
Oh, right. Yeah, we still use gas. I think what I've been told and what I've experienced is that gas stoves give a more even cook than an electric one. And it also has more versatility, I suppose, because it gives it more like a grill, how do I describe it? Because we use the gas for just about everything. We use it for broiling, which is just to sear something really quick. We use it for saute, but then we also use it for prep, which is basically to make soup, stocks, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so what I've been told is that we use that still for an even cook. And electricity is not the most reliable.
I was going to say reliable as well. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, and when you need something heated really quick, which is all the time in a restaurant, like, oh, we need this on the fly, a server forgot to ring it in, or we need this cooked up to temperature really fast, or we need something heated up, it's a matter of turning on a fire, which is already really hot, versus an electric burner, which takes 10 minutes to heat up on high. You know mm-hmm, what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's a huge difference in quality and time. If I had to turn on, like, okay, I need to cook something really quick, saute some onions,
right,
in 30 seconds, there is no way that would be possible with an electric burner just waiting to heat up, my pan.
Got it.
You know, it just take way too long.
Yeah, so are there any alternatives that are coming up for the professional kitchens that could save? Because at the end of the day, cooking gas is not exactly going to be very easily available in the near future. So obviously there's...
Really?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're running out of that resource very soon. I mean, it's a depleting resource. Not just cooking gas, any fuel.
That's true.
Any fossil fuel is not that straightforward to get. I mean, so...
That's true. I think worst come to worst, we would just go back to, and a lot of restaurants still do this for the novelty. We would go back to wood fire grills and things like that.
Right.
At my old restaurant, we actually, that was our specialty. It's ironic now because just like with anything, throwbacks and things in the 90s, or, you know, like if you think of fashion, you know, it's the same parallel as it is with cooking. Like any throwback or something becomes artisan. It becomes a novelty that people will pay more for the experience. So if you had a wood-fired steak or something versus something that was just a regular steak cooked, you know, it's suddenly like way more. You can smell the apple wood, mm-hmm. you know, it was great. You know, all these different things, that sensations that we can use, you know, to sell it, you know.
Absolutely.
And so that's kind of,
and I think a wood fire has a lot more a visceral feel to it. I wouldn't want to say visceral, but it has a more caveman like feel to it. It takes us back to our roots. It takes us back to the core,
exactly,
of what we feel, right? I mean, it's like me eat meat cooked on fire. So you know, you don't
exactly
really imagine a gas fire in that scenario. No, you're thinking of a cave fire with a wood and something being smoked or something being rolled on top of it. So yeah, that's essentially the imagery you get when you cook on a fire. And that's something that's very raw, very real. And going back to
that
does make sense. But again, so you're seeing a lot of, and this is also true for even home kitchens. Like you see a lot of people going back to grilling and smoking meats or even curing mm-hmm. them rather than relying on cooked meats on a gas, so to speak.
Exactly.
And is that something that you're seeing as well?
At home, I think so, but not really. At least here, I think that though people are driven to cook a little bit more, I think with our American culture, we cook with efficiency, you know, unfortunately. So a lot of the mm-hmm. things that are picking up, though, we're like very appliance driven. So if we can make it easier on us, then we'll do it. So there's electric grills now that we can have inside of our homes instead of going outside and like grilling, you know. So though old traditions are gaining in popularity, it's like an update, like 2.0, like 2020 2.0 of like how you would grill, or how you
I'm
going to
pick something against
something.
You now. I'm going to pick something on you, though, because you just said a few minutes ago that electric is not really efficient or reliable. So how does that change in a home kitchen environment?
Well, the thing is, though, restaurants are driven to serve as many people as quickly and as efficiently as possible without diminishing the quality of the food. So each meal has to taste the exact same, but still taste amazing, but as quickly as possible, because how restaurants make money is how quickly we can turn over a table. And nobody really likes to wait 45 minutes for their meal. You know, they want it rather quickly. Like 30 minutes is pretty reasonable. And by the time they get their appetizers and all these things, you know, but we get hundreds and hundreds of ticket orders, you know, for like one body. So we need to cook as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. However, at home, it's a different mentality. You're cooking for your family, for a dinner, for the night, you know. And so you can start that process an hour or two before and still make the meal, and that's okay. And so when you're not cooking as quickly, you can take that time to turn on your electric stove or grill or something and give it that time to heat up. Like, that's perfectly fine, because mm-hmm. you could use that other time to prep vegetables or whatever it may be for the meal. And by the time you're done with that, it'll be ready to go. So it's a different mentality when you're cooking at home. I don't think it's mostly for the how fast can I cook this? You know, it's more like, you know, you have the luxury of taking your time to be able to formulate the meal, right. You know? So it's a little bit of a different mindset when you're cooking.
Fair enough. A thought that comes to my mind, and we mentioned about using fire, are these wood fire pizza ovens and oh my God, the quality of the food that comes out of there. So what is your experience? I mean, are we seeing that sort of movement back to wood fires anytime soon? Is that going to happen, or is that going to be stuck to just those pizza places?
It just really depends on, there's so many different types of restaurants, you know, so it really just depends on what they're targeting. I don't think it will become something that's trending, because it requires a lot more work. And when it requires more work, then it's more of the upper class restaurants that will use things like that. And that's just honesty. So like a fast casual restaurant would never do something like that, because that's just way too much.
So luxury slow cooking sort of stuff.
Right,
maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's on the luxury side. You're only going to see that in a little bit more expensive restaurants, or big name chefs and stuff will use that on the day-to-day, you know. That's
fair enough. Well, thank you very much for this. It's been actually very insightful to get, you know, how technology and how engineering is helping the food industry, and it's I've learned quite a bit. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. Precious, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do this?
Oh, okay. You can find me anywhere under Precious Pioneer. I have a few YouTube channels. I have an Instagram and Twitter. But yeah, you can find me under Precious Pioneer.
Thank you very much. For my guest, I will link all of her YouTube channels in the show notes. She has a podcast of her own. Again, I shall link that in. It's called A Precious Foodie. I have been a guest on her episode, on her channel as well, and that will be linked in the show notes. So thank you very much to all of you listeners. Thank you very much for joining us for this episode. As usual, you can find our podcast on all of the major podcast players. So we're on Apple, Spotify, Google, and all of your different, and we're hosted by anchor.fm. All our social media is The East Podcast. Our website is eastpodcast.in. Feel free to reach out to me on email. Thank you very much for joining us for this episode. I had a lot of fun recording this with Precious. And we look forward to seeing you in the next one.